We're going to talk now about recent advances and persistent problems in mass rearing of phlebotomy and sandflies. I want to acknowledge those that have worked with me on that, Lisa Jones and Tobin Rowland and Elizabeth Broussard, our technicians in the sandfly insectaries. Ed Roten is the director of the sandfly section of the Division of Entomology, Walter Reed Army Institute of Research. And, he's the boss, he's the head man for that section. Sandflies, as you know, are important vectors of human pathogens, including viruses, bacteria, and protozoans. Among the viruses, we have several, most notably probably sandfly fever, but there are other viruses that are transmitted by sandflies and probably more that we don't know about. Human Bartonellosis is caused by Bartonella bacilliformis, which is transmitted to humans by the bites of sandflies, and this occurs in the rural villages in the Andes Mountains in Peru and Ecuador. And then leishmaniasis, which is probably the most important disease that, definitely is the most important disease that sandflies transmit, manifest in three forms: cutaneous leishmaniasis, mucocutaneous leishmaniasis, and the often fatal visceral leishmaniasis. It's because of this disease transmission that we find it necessary to raise sandfly colonies. The only natural vectors of leishmaniasis and these other diseases are sandflies. In the New World, the genus Lutzemaia contains the vector species, and in the Old World, the genus Phlebotomus contains the vector species. Here we see the sandflies of the Old World. You see the Leishmania species on the left. There are about 20 species of Leishmania that cause disease in humans. These are all transmitted by sandflies. Early on in research, it was hampered greatly by the lack of sandfly colonies, and recent advances have enabled us to colonize a lot of sandflies. And you see the ones in red are species that have been colonized. The ones that are underlined there in red are the ones that we have at Walter Reed and at NIH. These are the New World leishmanias and their vectors. Again, quite a number have been colonized. Now, this doesn't mean that these are all currently in colony. Some of them start off, they work on them for a while, and then they go defunct. Sandfly colonies are very important because they're the basic resource for this type of research. You have to have live vectors in order to conduct much of this research. So colonies are necessary for studies in sandfly biology and taxonomy and systematics, parasite biology, vector host and vector pathogen interactions, rapid diagnostics, vaccine development, surveillance techniques, repellent development, insecticide susceptibility, and vector control. So this connects the basic laboratory work with the field work. When we talk about mass rearing, we're talking about really working colonies. These are robust sandfly colonies with high productivity, sufficient numbers produced to sustain research demands on a continuous basis. And we're talking about 1,500 to 2,000 blood-fed sandflies a week going back into the colony. This will enable us to provide from one of those working colonies 500 to 700 flies per week. Now, there are many advances that have taken place in sandfly mass rearing, and I don't have time to cover all of them, so I'm just going to talk about four basic ones, four that have really enabled us to expand our colonies and make them available for research. Holding and mating cages. We had used plexiglass or polycarbonate cages with a plaster lining in them. The lining was there for a resting site for the sandflies. Plaster of Paris is a little heavy, so these cages were bulky. They had good visibility, but you could also maintain the humidity fairly well in them, but they're hard to clean, and this is very important. Sandflies don't tolerate bacterial infections very well. So we developed a cubic foot polycarbonate mating holding cage. This is what it looks like. It has a back that comes off, and you can replace the back with a with just benchtop paper, which provides a good resting surface for the flies. And this is what a cage looks like when it's full of sand flies. These cages are sturdy, durable, and they're lightweight. You have unimpeded visibility with these. They're washable, sanitizable. They can even be autoclaved. The screen on the top is easily replaceable, as is the access sock and the paper back, which provides the resting surface for the flies. And there's the resting surface for the flies. Transfer apparatuses. Traditionally, we've used mouth aspirators. This is the John Hawk company aspirator with a HEPA filter, which filters out the sandfly CD. This is good. However, they are efficient, but they're slow, and it's difficult to transfer large numbers of flies to cages or to containers in a short amount of time. And also, if you get too many of them in the aspirator, it traumatizes the flies, it injures them, and they may die, or it causes problems there. Another problem is throat irritation and coughing after frequent or long use. Some allergies still exist even with the HEPA filter. So we developed a vacuum aspirator for loading of our standard 500 ml ovipots. This is just a simple device that fits over the top of the pot. This port goes through a hole in the screen, and one of the hoses goes into the cage, and the other hose goes to the vacuum source, and we're ready to go. And here Lisa's loading up this ovipot. I'll use the mouse. Loading up the ovipot with sand flies. We put about 120 flies in these pots. And then when it's through, we just pull the screen over under the rubber band, and it's ready to go. These aspirators are easy to use. You have adjustable vacuum, which reduces the trauma to the flies. It saves time. You can gently transfer large numbers of flies, I mean like thousands, in a short period of time. It eliminates the irritation and allergy due to inhalation of sandfly CT. Then we made a one-size-fits-all vacuum aspirator because we have different size containers when we provide them for other people. Here's a gallon container being loaded with this one-size-fits-all aspirator, and this is a pint paper carton. And this is very useful. This really speeds up our work and enhances our ability to mass rear. Larva food preparation has historically been a problem. One of the problems is just having enough around and not running out, because it takes a long time to prepare. We've used these cabinets for some time. The problem is this is messy. Sandfly food is made up of 50% rabbit feces and 50% rabbit chow, ground up and put into these trays about a centimeter thick, moistened. By the time you're through preparing it, it takes a long time, and you have dust and everything all over the place. So I started looking for something that might be able to replace this, and I Googled composters on Google, and look what I found. Nature Mill automatic composter. This is for household use. So I thought, well, let's try it. And we tried it, and lo and behold, it works. And within 2 weeks, we have great sandfly food. One of these will accommodate as much food as an entire cabinet. This is a little bigger than a bread box, about the size of a large paper shredder, and it's very handy. Here it is in operation. There's a little light that goes on that says when it's ready. You put the raw materials in, the rabbit feces. You don't have to grind them. You just take them raw, the rabbit feces and rabbit chow, throw them in there, put in the water with them, and there's a mixing arm that mixes this every 8 hours. And after 2 weeks, a little light goes on and says, well, I'm ready. And it's ready, and then it's supposed to drop through a trap door in the bottom, but the consistency of our food's a little hard, so it doesn't do it. So you have to reach in there with a glove on your hand and open it. But it drops through, and you have very nice compost, like potting soil, that's ready for use with the sandflies. You just dry it and grind it. This also has a heater. It has an odor eater, an air filter to filter out the smells. So it's good to have. Our next advance is advances in control of animal pathogens. Some of you that have raised sandflies may have seen this. have seen a crash in your colonies. This one, particular one, was due to Gregorin infestations. Gregorins normally in sandflies are kind of a commensal organism, but in laboratory colonies, under intense colonization conditions, they proliferate and they cause the, eventually can cause the colony to crash, which happened to us. What you see here is a gamont, and many gamonts get together, or a couple get together, and form a gametocyst. The gametocyst attaches to the accessory gland of the female and then expels the oocysts into the accessory gland, which are then, the oocysts are then coated onto the eggs as they're passed out, and then the larvae eat the oocysts, and that's how it's carried on. Well, we experimented with a few techniques to try to overcome this, and found a good egg washing procedure that really works. Now, I want to point out here, this is a water pick. This is the best thing since metal tips on shoelaces. I mean, this is great, and it's got a tongue washing nozzle, you know, for washing your tongue. But this will wash out a pot of eggs, get 100% of the eggs in a very short time. We wash them into the sieve, and then we can rinse them in whatever solution we want, and it's amazing. Another thing that I just looked up on Google, and it worked. It's amazing what you can find on Google. Here's the procedure. You wash the pots out, dump it into a soil test sieve, a very fine mesh soil test sieve, and then you can rinse it in 1%. We use a 1% Clorox solution for 1 minute, and then rinse it 1 minute in water and put it back into a clean pot. And here's what happened. Once we started our egg washing, initiated that, we virtually controlled the Gregorins in our colony. Now, those are the four great advances. We still have problems, and there are persistent problems that go on. Mold and fungus, mites, continued problems with Gregorins, blood feeding, adapting laboratory colonies, loss of susceptibility to Leishmania, which is of great concern, sustained production, labor intensity and cost, and initiating new colonies. These are all problems that we work on and overcome. Here's a picture of some entomopathogenic fungi. When the larvae are large and there are good numbers, they can manage it. They eat the mycelia. But if there aren't enough of them, it overgrows, and in the third or the fourth instar in the pupal stage, the larvae are not feeding. So these molds and fungi continue to grow. And this one shows some adults trapped in the sticky fungus, and it'll just wipe out an entire pot. So what we've done, and it works somewhat, but we haven't completely controlled it, and we wash the pots thoroughly and actually freeze them. We rinse them in Clorox. Sometimes we use alcohol, maintain the optimum level of larval density, maintaining optimum moisture and humidity, and we shake the pots frequently to break up the hyphae and the mycelium. Mites. Mites are always in sandfly colonies, a perennial problem, and it seems to come in the wintertime when it's cooler weather. I'm not sure how they can tell that it's winter in our insectary, but it seems to make a difference. Egg washing procedures help a great deal, actually. Remove when we have the eggs in a pot before we've added any food, we go through with a vacuum aspirator and suck out as many of the mites as we can. Again, it's important to manage moisture and temperature and manage the food. Don't overfeed. If there's too much food, that will encourage the mites. And we still have problems with Gregorins. You see, we did have good success with most of our colonies with egg washing. But with the Phlebotomus sergenti, it's a different species of Gregorin, and it's much more resistant to our efforts. And we've been working just recently, and we're still on an experiment, but using 1% Clorox for 3 minutes, or 3% Clorox for 1 minute, with a preliminary alcohol rinse seems to be working, and I don't have the data to show you right now, but it looks really good. And so I think we'll even have that one controlled soon. When you lose susceptibility to Leishmania in a colony, that kind of spoils all the fun with the research. So it's very important that these sandfly colonies are susceptible to the species that they're supposed to transmit. I don't know every solution, but I think it helps to infuse the colony with fresh material from the field. The danger with that, of course, is introducing gregarins and other pathogens. But it's still probably the best way to do it. Blood feeding sometimes is a problem because you get a colony or material from the field. They don't readily adapt to the laboratory animals that you have. And they sometimes, well, we have two colonies that will only feed on me and will not feed on mice or guinea pigs or hamsters. Enough of them won't feed so that we can maintain the colonies. So I turn out to be the guinea pig. We've tried many experiments with membrane feeding, and we've had good success, but only certain species will feed well on the membranes. Phlebotomus papatossi does a great job. One of the things we're worried about is if we do raise them entirely on membranes, that they'll lose the predilection for live animal blood, and the transmission experiments then won't be feasible. Sustained use and production. This is an example of a large working colony. In the white, you see the total number of females that were captured or were released. In the red or the purple are the numbers that went into research, and the blue are the ones that went back into the colony. Well, with this one, you notice that there was a peak and then it went down. We've discovered that if we use more than half of the flies that are produced for experimentation, the colony drops. So our rule of thumb is to use a third for experimentation and two-thirds to go back into the colony to make sure that our colonies are robust and strong. I have 1 minute. Okay. Initiating new colonies. It's important to have good source material. Sometimes when we get source material or colony material from other labs, we get all the warts and things with it, or all the gregarins and things along with that. But if you go to the field, you get the same thing. You get wild ectoparasites. So it's important when you bring them in that you rear them as isolines so that you can check them for identification as well as for gregarins or other parasites. They have to be adapted to the colony. Sandfly colonies are very labor intensive anyway. We figure we spend about 100 man hours a week in our colonies. We have 15 at Walter Reed and then six or five over at the NIH. Plus, it's probably around $1,000 a day with when you consider everything with all the colonies that we've got. So it's labor intensive and expensive. For several years, I've been maintaining a sandfly colony database. It was on the Armed Forces Pest Management Board website. I haven't been able to find it lately, but I'm revising it, and we'll put it back on there, and as soon as I've got it back on, I'll send out a notification so that people will know where it is. I think this would be a good resource for sandfly workers. Right now, there are over 20 sandfly species, multiple strains of these species in colony. From 26 laboratories, there are over 100 total colonies, and this represented in 15 countries. Do we have some time for questions? Do you have any questions? Yes, sir.
Have you done any molecular work to see whether your colonies are about as, how similar they are to a field population?
To field population. The question is, have we done any molecular work to detect, to see if they're close to field populations? We have done some work with early colonies and then later colonies and comparing them. And Jesus Valenzuela and others at NIH have looked at things like salivary components and cDNA libraries and so forth, and they seem to compare quite well. But I'm sure there are some changes that take place, and that's why it's important to infuse the colony with new material.
Well, there is variability. Actually, he worked on a sandfly F-15. They worked on field samples and colony samples. So there is variability depending on the molecule. There's been evidence done with cytochrome B also to availability, but we are actually doing this currently in other things.
There's been some isolation studies too, showing that it will become more homogeneous.
Any other questions?
I have another question kind of related to it. Is there any indication that, I mean, do you actually have proof that the external Euclidean samplies from the field that it actually goes back into the colony, or because those have got such a highly adaptive field behaviors, you don't really see gene flow coming back in?
Well, just by the behavior of the colony and so forth, you can tell the difference. But I don't have any molecular data to show that I've got a gene flow coming back in. But it does make a difference, and it keeps the colony robust and strong. Hanafi?
Yeah, I'm checking about our colony. We found that non-thrive, it means to be ill. All of the ones made the same amount of size of the container, which are all the eggs that touch the
Well, ours lay eggs sometimes on the sides of the containers, but with the egg washing procedure, they wash right off, and we just put them back in the pot. I'm not sure of the solution. Let's talk about that afterwards. We need to move on. One more question here, and then.
Have you done any exercise with fellows in that field? Could you tell us briefly how you performed?
Well, at Walter Reed, there are projects going on in repellent testing, and one of the presentations today will be on the repellent testing that's going on.